first item on the agenda is the adoption of the rules, but we'll wait till the senators get here. The second item is Mr. Fisher from the Region Candidate Advisory Council, the chair. Mr. Fisher, would you like to come forward and say a few words? Welcome to the committee. Senators, we're happy to have you. It's nice of you to show up.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We were doing very important work on the floor of the Senate, Mr. Chair, to respond to a very important bill that the House initiated. So.
Welcome, Chair. Thank you. Ms. Chair, Senator Pappas and members of the Joint Legislative Committee, my name is David Fisher. I'm a resident of the city of Minneapolis. I'm a former Minnesota Commissioner of Administration. We're usually long forgotten the day we leave, but nevertheless, you may recognize me. But I'm now privileged to chair the Region's Candidate Advisory Council, which is a body created by and for the purpose of assisting the Minnesota State Legislature. So we're here at your request and at your service. As you know, this year the Board of Regents has four positions for regents that are coming to term in each of the 1st, 4th, 6th, and 7th congressional districts. And our Regents Candidate Advisory Council has recommended to this committee candidates for your consideration. I was asked to give a bit of an explanation of what this council is, and I will do that. As you know, and as I'm sure your staff has advised you as well, the Constitution of the State of Minnesota requires that 12 regents be elected by a joint convention of the Minnesota Legislature to sit on the Board of Regents. They're serving staggered six-year terms for the purpose of governing the university. And one-third, or four, of the Board of Regents is elected each odd-numbered year. The Minnesota law also states that 8 of the 12 regents must reside in Minnesota's congressional districts, one in each district, and the 4 remaining regents, as you know, are elected from the state at large, with one of those being a university student at the time of election. The Regents Candidate Advisory Council is established by statute by the legislature for the purpose of identifying, recruiting, screening, and recommending qualified candidates to this committee. The council has 24 members, including 2 student members appointed by the House and by the Senate for a staggered term. That is, each of us are appointed by the House and Senate to assist. And it is truly a citizens' council. We have representatives from every corner of our state, each serving without compensation, but out of a sense of service to our state, the University of Minnesota, and our legislature. And as once said by a British statesman, Henry Peter Brougham, education makes people easy to lead, but difficult to drive, easy to govern, but impossible to enslave. And that may be as good a reason as any why 24 of us just choose to serve as citizen volunteers. As a part of our charge, the council acts on behalf of the legislature in developing selection criteria for recruiting and screening region candidates. And these criteria have been reported to this committee in a report that I submitted earlier this year. It includes issues of diversity in geography, gender, ethnicity, occupation, and experience. And we use these criteria to help identify membership needs of the Board of Regents, including the skills and characteristics necessary to govern a complex organization such as the university, consistent with the need for broad diversity in backgrounds and experiences. Then we go out and find candidates, which may be the one largest single useful task that we really bring to this, is finding qualified individuals for recommendation to the legislature. And finally, the council is charged to make these recommendations to this committee of 2 to 4 candidates for each open seat. So what we have done, and as I've indicated, we prepared a set of criteria, and we submitted to this court, or to this court, this committee, you can tell I'm a lawyer, to this committee. And the criteria include both a personal component, that is, including a view to the sustainability and success of the university, vision, independence, ability to work in complex environments, diversity and ethics, and also a professional component, including experience in governing large complex organizations, accomplishment, knowledge, and expertise. And we try to fit that in with the needs of the regents at the time these regents are recommended to this committee. Using these criteria as our guide, the council did conduct an extensive search for candidates from each of the 4 congressional districts. We used advertisements, public registrations, direct contact with organizations such as the Minnesota League of Cities and Association of Minnesota Counties, direct contact with legislators in the district, mailings to region candidate applicants from prior years, and old-fashioned word of mouth, including direct requests of interest. And as a result, we have had a total of 31 applications. After reviewing these applications, the council interviewed 14 finalists. And in the case of each of these finalists, the council reviewed candidate applications and essays, as well as references from at least three individuals, and conducted an interview lasting 45 minutes for each finalist, featuring an extensive question and answer period. So it's a fairly arduous process, but one we gladly undertook. On behalf of the council, it is my privilege to report that from among these finalists, the council is referring 8 candidates for consideration by the Joint Legislative Committee. I can say that the breadth of experience and expertise of the applicants made this process extremely difficult. This was not an easy task, but one that each of us took very seriously. We stayed the course, we followed the law in our estimation, we followed our criteria, and we are proud to present the candidates for your consideration today. Now, I had down here a description of the candidates, but I'm going to assume that each of you know who they are, and you have a report on each of them, and they're here, of course, to be interviewed by each of you. I do say that we're proud of the selections we have made and the recommendations we have made, and are willing to stand behind those 100%. I did want to indicate that we also are indebted to a vast network of people. In particular, we give special thanks to the University of Minnesota Alumni Association staff, as well as the fine staff of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, Sally Kidd and Diane Henry, for making this such a smooth process. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be available for questions of committee.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Fisher, Representative Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fisher, thank you very much for your service. How long have you been on the RCAC?
This is my fourth cycle, so perhaps 8 years.
8 years. And so there's the term for RCAC, Mr. Chairman, the term is 4 years?
It's a six-year term
on RCAC. Someone has brought up the idea to me of perhaps we should have a limit on the RCAC of 2 terms, similar to the kind of self-imposed limit that the regions have. Do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Fisher.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Pappas, one of the things we did at the end of this cycle is we did a survey of our membership. That is one of the questions we asked, whether it should be a formal or an informal imposition of some kind of term limit.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the council has reported back saying that they did not prefer that, that that really was a legislative prerogative. Since we are the appointees of the House and the Senate,
mm-hmm.
the legislature should probably make the determination of whether there should be an imposed term limit.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
A point of clarification. The Constitution has no term limits on how many times a region can serve.
Right.
It was imposed by this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I think...
They actually won't recommend to us someone that's had more than 2 terms, but we can vote for whoever we want on the...
Mr. Chairman, are you saying that the RCAC has a policy of not recommending a region
I believe
who has
case.
After 2 terms? Is that true, Mr.
Fisher? Can you clarify that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, my understanding is that we do not impose a term limit, but there is, as we understand it, an informal understanding among the sitting members of the regents that 2 terms is a type of informal qualification.
We'll check on that.
Ms. Chair, if I could clarify, if you don't mind. We do not have that as a part of our criteria. In fact, I believe the statute forbids our committee from considering term limits as a part of the criteria.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You have one more question.
Oh, I
get
one more question,
late.
Mr. Fisher. You were allowed to recommend 2 to 4 candidates for each position, and I think typically in the past there has been some variation for each seat. Was there any particular reason why this time only 2 were recommended for each open seat?
Chair, Senator Pappas. We did not make any formal determination of that, but there was a sentiment, I know, of the council that we wanted to only report to this committee the people we thought were the very best qualified and not overload the slate. But no, there was no conscious effort to limit it to just two per district as it turned out to be.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fisher. Members, we have the rules then in front of us. The rules are in your packets. I think the rules were sent out to members. Are there any questions on the rules at all?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions, I would move that we adopt the rules.
Then a motion to adopt the rules. If there are no further questions or motions to amend, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The next item then would be, members, we will be listening today, just listening and asking questions of the candidates that have been recommended, but our rules offer a nomination of anyone that is not on the candidate list that with a majority vote from both sides that there it's open to recommend other candidates being able to be presenting today and interviewed. So are there any motions?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the motion requires three House members and two senators for the persons named to be entered into nomination.
Okay, I stand corrected. Representative Haas.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to make a recommendation or a motion for endorsement. May I do so now?
This is the time to do it. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I would like to put John Frobenius's name into for our election from the 6th District. He serves now on the university as a regent, and I think his experience would be continue to be a benefit. I know John from more than just stopping in the office and doing a few minutes of an interview. I know him because he comes from St. Cloud, and he has served the St. Cloud and Central Minnesota area very well, and I'm appreciative of that. He has shown
Representative Haas, can you just nominate in that today, and then you can give us speech of support for him in the process if you get the necessary votes on Tuesday? Okay?
If I had two more sentences, I would have had that completed.
I'll give you 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I think it's fine. He's interviewed with people, but I think he brings balance to the system. I think he brings consistency to the system, and I think he also has a little bit of bioscience that is certainly a beacon in a very dark economy. Thank you.
Okay, and that's the nomination. Is there a second?
I second it.
Representative Detner, and a third even. Senator Clark. And, okay, a bunch. I don't think
I would give a third.
Well, I would. That's what I want then. So, do we have a show of hands? Are there three, at least three and two? Okay, there's the necessary votes on both sides. So, Mr. Frobenius then will be also allowed to present and have questions asked today. Are there any candidates for any of the other congressional districts? Okay. Are there any reports from congressional district members? There is a report from Representative Lesh, who called a 4th District congressional district caucus on February 25th. That report is in your packet. And are there any other congressional districts that would like to report? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 1st congressional district has met, and we are currently polling our members. And so I will be able to report by Tuesday.
Okay. Are there any comments from the 7th or 6th? Okay. Then with that, we will move into the question and answer period. Let's presentations. Why don't we go by congressional district and then in that regard, we will have, we'll just go by the current sitting ones, perhaps, and then move on. So, Ms. Krista Simmons from the 1st District first, and then we'll have Mr. Simonson next. Welcome to the committee. Regent Simmons, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Rubina,
honorable senators and representatives. I very much appreciate your giving me the opportunity to potentially continue in public service. If you wonder if this process makes candidates nervous, I'd like to tell you that last night I slept all night. I had a dream that you changed the process, I didn't get the memo, and that we were to discuss the subtle elements of an obscure Greek myth.
That will happen on Tuesday.
Oh, I know. When you sent me to the Board of Regents 6 years ago, I tried to bring experiences in my career and my life that I thought would serve the people of Minnesota. And the experiences I brought were predominantly in leadership at the Mayo Clinic, where I'd been an executive. When I was elected, I resigned those positions. But the experience included chairing Mayo Medical Ventures, which is the new business development arm of Mayo Clinic, and also developing strategic planning for Mayo, particularly Mayo's national strategy. I'd also served in national professional organizations in leadership roles and had the opportunity to oversee CEOs, select CEOs in both situations. I also brought a deep commitment to the best interest of Minnesotans, recognizing the critical role the university plays in creating the future of our state, and a sense of great responsibility and accountability to the people for that. While on the board, some things have happened that I believe have really heightened what I can bring to serve the people of Minnesota. One is listening to the people of Minnesota. I've had great opportunities, and in part thanks to many of you, to get out around the state, listen to the needs and expectations of citizens for the university, hear how the university is performing in their communities. In addition, I've met with many of you through the last 6 years and have appreciated some of the guidance, some of the feedback, and some of the, let's call them, discussions that we've had. They've been valuable. They've informed my decisions on the board and allowed me, I think, to contribute in a richer way. As I go forward, if I am able to continue serving on the board, I would continue being chair of the Board of Regents. And I'd like for you to know that I've used my opportunity as chair of the board to try to work with each regent to make sure we maximally use their talents and skills and to create a cohesive body, because we are headed for some very difficult, challenging decisions in the years ahead. And fortunately, we are functioning in a way that I believe we can take them on. Going forward, I see critical issues the board will need to address on behalf of the people of Minnesota, and I'll just highlight three. One is that there will be leadership changes in the university. There always are, but a number of critically important ones are coming together. I have had the opportunity in my career to select six CEOs, including for multi-billion dollar organizations, and I've taken out two CEOs. I'm not afraid to do that when the time comes. A second area we will undertake is really looking at the future of the Academic Health Center and the medical school and how they contribute to the critical mission of the state in research, in educating our healthcare workforce, and in engaging and serving the public. The President has asked that I be an active participant because of my background in academic medicine, and I'm pleased if I get to do that. And third, we will deal with the budget that you send us and the other funds that we receive from other sources. Critical decisions will be made. During those decisions, we will respect the critical importance of accessibility, affordability of the university, and respect for the people who work there. I'll close my remarks by thanking you again for the honor of considering me for service to the people of Minnesota. And I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, what I think I'll do is have both, all of the candidates from each district present, and then we'll have them up there together for questions. And I didn't tell the committee that there is a 5-minute time limit. We did tell the candidates that we have some little signs up here, so. We could have held them up for Mr. Fisher, but we didn't. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Simonson. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. It's a privilege and an honor for me to be here. My oldest son, Josh, encouraged me to apply for this seat. He said, Dad, we spent a lot of time at holidays, over dinner, on the telephone, via email, talking about the university. He said, this is an opportunity to move beyond that. My family has held a close connection with the University of Minnesota for many years. I did my PhD there in veterinary microbiology. I served as an adjunct assistant professor there. I've served on committees such as curriculum review committees. I've served on key staffing committees, external advisory board member for the Food Animal Biotechnology Center. My company has contributed substantial funds over the years to support research at the University of Minnesota. I've hired many University of Minnesota graduates into my company, and myself and my company have contributed to endowed chairs. My son Josh has a master's in public health from the University of Minnesota. He did an MD at the Minnesota. He's currently a senior resident in radiology. My daughter Anna did her undergraduate work in history there. So I'm here today because I care about the University of Minnesota. Early in this process, I was asked to identify how I would make a significant difference to the continued success of the university, what my qualifications are to do that. My resume is available, so I think if you want to look at that, you could. However, there are many important issues confronting the university today that I believe my years in private industry and years of working with this university and universities around the world would contribute to working through some of the issues. For example, affordable education, especially at the undergraduate level. Higher education is challenged to find ways to continue operating in a cost-effective manner. Holding the line on tuition and attracting the best students has been and will be an ongoing challenge for this university. This will require some very different and difficult choices with regards to how we are organized, how we operate, and ultimately how we budget. My 28 years plus experience in private industry has given me many opportunities to review, refine, and fund strategic plans to consider the reality of the times that we're living in. Another area that I think is critical is funding for research and applying that resulting technology. We know research dollars from the public sector have become very difficult. Federal, state funds have become difficult as a nonprofit. This has led faculty members to rely more and more on private sources to fill the void. I believe this trend will continue for some time and provided some special challenges to the university in terms of professionalism, ethics, and out-licensing. I have worked for years with researchers at the University of Minnesota and universities around the world and have witnessed good and not so good outcomes from these relationships. This experience has given me an understanding how this university must recognize and deal with these issues in the future. Economic development is another important issue. The University of Minnesota has a responsibility to educate and discover, but along with this, this institution plays a major role in the economic well-being of our people. Actually, I believe the economic well-being of the University of Minnesota and the state of Minnesota are joined at the hip. Working together with state government, Minnesota private industry, trade organizations, the university can and must remain a leader in promoting economic development for Minnesota. I've worked with a number of regional economic development committees and foundations searching for ways to create jobs and enhance quality of life for our citizens. This work could involve city, county, and state government, as well as representation in the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota. I have a deep interest in these programs being expanded for the betterment of all our citizens. Finally, our charter given to us in 1851 states in part that the objective of this university is to provide the inhabitants of this territory with the means to acquire knowledge in literature, arts, and sciences. We do this, but as the world has become smaller, it's easy to lose sight of that obligation. I've spent the last 2 decades plus working in rural Minnesota and with agriculture. I understand the needs and the importance of the University of Minnesota in helping to meet these needs. So I leave it to you to decide if my qualifications are worthy of going to the next stage. If you are satisfied in the way that the University of Minnesota is operating now, don't vote for me. If you aren't, I'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Simmons, would you like to come down then for questions from the committee? Are there any questions? If you want to just both come down and arm wrestle with the questions of the candidates. Well, I guess I'll ask one. I've had some emails on the grad school and the elimination of it, and there's a lot of concerned students about that. And my understanding was there wasn't really any questions or input from the students, and I even understand from the faculty. And so I'm wondering
why this has been proposed, and you know, my understanding from some of the grad students is that the grad school, it does act as an ombudsman and coordinator and everything else, and I'm wondering what the quality is going to be like. So, Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina and members of the Joint Committee. The decision to close the graduate school was a decision about administrative structure, not about content or programs. Content and programs are completely preserved, as are services to students. The decision has been under discussion, as I understand it, because I looked into it too, for about a decade, and a lot of involvement and consultation. When the ultimate decision was made by the president and provost, it was with consultation of faculty leadership, particularly the deans of all of the involved schools. The graduate school effectively remains in place, but an administrative structure is being taken out. The two reasons for this are, number one, the university has got to take out costs. And the costs that it needs to take out are those that aren't directly providing services to students and contributing directly to the mission. And this is an expensive structure that wasn't felt to be necessary. The second reason is there really is a lot of talent in the level of the deans, and to have yet another level on top didn't make sense over the long run. I will tell you that since the decision, the university has had multiple inquiries from around the United States from university leaders asking, how do you do that? We need to do it too.
Mr. Thompson, would you care to comment at all?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know if I could add much more. I support that totally. I think that's the beginning of dealing with the budget issue that the university has. I think we need to look at that broader than just graduate school. I think there's a lot of redundancy. I think we can reduce that redundancy and still not suffer in quality.
Representative Mahoney.
To the candidates, the University of Minnesota is... Well, in my opinion, it's the premier institute of higher learning in the state of Minnesota. But it also has a different mission in the state as an economic engine for the state, and the not only just the talent that comes out of it, but the ideas and the and the products that they envision and design and move on. Could you please share, both of you, please share with me and the rest of the committee, how you envision the university partaking in the economic vitality of our state.
Mr. Simonson, why don't you answer that one?
Well, this has been near and dear to me for many years. I've seen technology. My company, as a matter of fact, has spent millions of dollars that we sent to Europe on a technology that we have sublicensed that came out of the University of Minnesota. I think we need to put Minnesota first. Another issue that's very near and dear to me, I've talked about it for years, is some sort of a interface between basic research and the ultimate technology that comes out of it. I think the university would be well served to be able to take that basic technology to a further stage before they out-license it. That interface, just like WashU has at St. Louis, that interface could be used to teach, to train, to get that technology to a further state so the university could realize more of its value. And so that would be another way that I think the university could benefit from its own technology. Lastly, I think that the university needs to give consideration to Minnesota first as they start to out-license this technology.
Ms. Simmons.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina and members of the Joint Committee. There are three reasons why it's critical that the university aggressively and actively commercialize its intellectual property, particularly the discoveries. One is it's the law. When you receive federal funding, you must make an attempt. And the reason for that is the federal government has made an investment, and they want to see the discoveries get into people's lives and improve our economy and the quality of life. A second, of course, is that there's the opportunity to generate revenue for the institution and the faculty who are involved in the discoveries. And that becomes increasingly important as the university needs to identify additional revenue sources. And third, the discoveries don't do anybody any good unless you get them into our lives and get them to market. So I think it's compelling that we do this. There, in order for the university to be effective, and it can be more effective than it is, and it should, and it will,
There must be policies in place, there must be infrastructure in place, and there must be a culture that encourages disclosure and appropriate commercialization. I see with the hires in recent years, with the attitudes, with the opportunities, more coming our way. And this is critically important for Minnesota's future. It always has been, now more than ever. I think you're going to see more good things come. I think some of you heard Vice President Mulcahy speak not long ago about some recent good examples of high success where the university is really leading the way nationally in some new ways of commercializing IP, particularly the Mayo Genomics Partnership. We heard about it within Mahoney's committee.
Members, if no one minds, I think we'll hold the questions to a two-minute response. We'll be holding it up, otherwise we're going to be running way over. Okay, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the candidates. We all agree that the academics and research is a big part of the university experience. I have a question regarding the intercollegiate athletics in terms of Title IX issues that we see going on in the intercollegiate athletics right now. The Title IX issue has been a great lift for the women's programs, but we're seeing across the country where many men's programs are eliminated so that they are in compliance with Title IX. Could you make some comments about that?
Ms. Simmons.
Thank you, Representative Detmer, members of the Joint Committee. I'll make a few comments. First of all, the university, I think, has work to do, but has done remarkably better than the national standard in terms of responding to Title IX. Outcomes of the university's interpretation of Title IX have been increased students, men and women, in competitive athletics. I just looked at a list this morning, too, of the academic accomplishment of the student athletes. There were over 200 with grade point averages of 3.5 or better. There were over 50 with 4.0 or better. So I think the university has really done some hard work to make sure that interpreting interpreting Title IX in a creative way has provided more opportunities for students of both genders, and including the recreational sports program. So I think, yep, there are probably things that can and will be done better with the merged programs into one athletic director's office. There's great opportunity to do that. Thank you for the question.
I really don't have much to add to that. I certainly support the sports academics are first in my mind, and the students have to have the grade point average.
Okay, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and candidates, in 2003, during our last recession, the legislature cut funding for the university by 15%. The response from the university at that time was to raise tuition to make up most of the cut through raising tuition. The governor has recommended during this current recession a 10.7%. We don't know yet what the legislature will do, but probably the legislature will cut. What will be the strategies that you recommend to the president and the administration this time? And does the Board of Regents, I assume actually you do set the tuition?
Mr. Simonson.
I certainly am not in favor of a tuition increase. I think it's too costly right now. I think we need to first look at other things. We have in my company, we have a strategic plan. We're looking at the end of the first quarter. If things aren't looking good, we're going to, we have four things. We're going to freeze salaries. Second thing, we would cut salaries starting at the top. Third thing is we'll reduce benefits. The very last thing we do is do layoffs. I think we need to look at these things before we look at increased revenue on tuition. That's the very first. I'd look at cutting costs before I look at increasing revenues by raising tuition.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, first and foremost, there will be a budget cut. The university is preparing for it and has been preparing for that potential for weeks with modeling. The modeling includes a number of variables, and the final decisions will be made by the Board of Regents and will be made based on principles. And the first principle will be maintaining affordability and affordability and accessibility to students and families so there's not the financial barrier. Second, and not below it, but equally important, is respect for people and respect for communities. In order to take costs out quickly, it means either raising new revenue immediately, the only place that one can really do that is tuition, and or putting people out of work. and both of those are serious decisions. I believe, I can't speak for the board hasn't acted, I believe there will be some level of tuition increase as part of the formula, not to the level of the 2003 decisions, not as big of a percent in terms of taking care of the deficit, but I believe there will be some, and the effort will be to mitigate, to prevent lowest-income students and middle-income students from feeling that increase, keeping it modest.
Thanks. Representative Poppen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Simmons and Dr. Simonson. I think you represent the First District well. And I am, since you're a little bit more familiar with the Southern Minnesota, I wanted to talk a little bit about the remote locations of the University of Minnesota, and not just talking about the Crookston, Duluth kind of areas, but also talking about the Hormel Institute in Austin, the Waseca Research Station, to be able to talk about how you see the role of the responsibility for the university to maintain and support and guide and grow the research stations and the centers that we have in other areas of Minnesota.
Ms. Simmons.
Thank you. First of all, I think this is a strategy that is critically important, not just because we'd like to see distribution of the university in our communities, but I think it's a good economic strategy. You stimulate industry in those communities, but also by getting closer to some particular areas and activities, you bring in more ideas and relationships. A great example is when we talked about down in District 1, you've got the Hormel Institute, you've got the Waseca Research Center, you've got the Mayo Clinic and University of Mayo Genomics Partnership, and an Ag Extension Regional Office all in one place. They definitely feed on each other, and I think the sustainability and the growth is heightened because of that type of relationship. It's critical for the university to be all around the state for a lot of good reasons that you know, and that's why you raised the question. And I think we will see those successes trigger even more commitment around Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Simonson.
I'd like to see a cost-benefit study on that. I think we have, again, a lot of redundancy. My company, again, has worked here in the very out state in Worthington, Minnesota. We work closely with the University of Minnesota. I don't mind the three-hour drive up here. We have the academic corporate relations group that reaches out to Minnesota. We have Extension that reaches out to Minnesota. I don't know about these facilities, whether or not they're cost-effective. I'd like to see a study done on that.
Thank you. And the last then question, Senator Stenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quick one, Senator.
To the candidates, in what major ways would you want the University of Minnesota to look differently 6 years from now if you are elected?
Mr. Simonson.
I'll go back to what I said in the beginning. This is a land-grant university. I would like to see the university refocus that mission. For example, the state of Minnesota is the third leading livestock industry with regards to swine in the country. Okay, we're behind Iowa, we're behind North Carolina. We're not going to get any bigger. There are environmental concerns with regard to that, but we can be the best. We can be the most efficient. I was at a dinner looking for an endowed, searching for an endowed chair. A couple weeks ago, the question was asked by veterinarians in that room to the faculty members at the College of Veterinary Medicine, we haven't seen you. Why haven't we seen you? They're too involved in other things. The answer was, I'm busy with research. They're traveling around the world, trying to reach out, trying to become this entity. I think we need to refocus on Minnesota, and that's the main thing I would like to see.
Okay, Ms. Simmons.
Thank you, Senator Sengem, and members. The Board of Regents charged the administration to develop a strategic plan for the university to answer that very question. And the answer came back that was approved, the university needs to be better than it is. And there are specific components of being better than it is. And I'll just highlight a few because this is what I'd like to see 6 years from now in the university. One is, it is affordable, that we don't go down a path of creating effectively a private university. A second is that we are more efficient and effective in delivering on the mission, and that's the threefold mission of public engagement, research, and education, which are all nicely tied in together. And the third thing is, I'd like to see the university have a defined, guaranteed revenue stream so that it's not a series of, well, what shall we cut now, what shall we build now, what shall we cut now, but rather be marching on a steady progress. And we have opportunities to do that that I think are being explored, and 6 years from now, I hope they're all in place.
Okay. Thank you very much, candidates. Appreciate your
your comments and the question answers to the questions. I'm going to move things around because of the snowstorm, and I'll have the 7th District member come down next. And Mr. Allen, go ahead and go first, since you're the incumbent. Welcome to the committee. Remember, you've got 5 minutes.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I thought I had lots of time. I was sitting back there writing my speech. But those of you who know me well know I usually have something ready anyway. It's good to be back with you. I have to say just one word. I spent 4 years before committees in this place, and people ask me, aren't you glad to be out of politics? And I said, those are some of the best 4 years of my life. I came out of here with good friends on both sides of the aisle, and I still value those relationships.
I won't grill you as hard as Representative Anderson used to do when he was chair of the tax committee.
And we were good personal friends. We sometimes had some policy differences, but we were good personal friends. I want to talk about three things very quickly. My background, some particular skills, and some issues. I've been in lots of different parts of government. I started out with the federal government, the National Security Agency. I spent 4 years as Commissioner of Revenue for this state. For 5 years on the Bloomington City Council, the same time I was on the council, I was on the Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and prior to that I had been on the Industrial Development Commission. My experience in private industry was with Honeywell, 17 years. I came here to work on the aerospace program, and then spent about 8 years on the corporate staff. Background in education, not my own education, but the background in education, it seems to be kind of the family business. Our whole family's been involved in it. My wife is a teacher and was on the Bloomington School Board. We have a son who has learning differences, and those came to light in the early days of learning differences. So we struggled together to find out how you work with some of those, and that was an education which I found very valuable in trying to help some others go through similar problems. I spent almost 20 years as Vice President for Business Affairs at Concordia College in Moorhead. And during part of that time, 15 years in fact, I also taught in the classroom. They asked me to fill in one semester, and I ended up doing it for 15 years. didn't get paid extra for it, but it was in the classroom with the students, and that's what the college was all about. And now I've had 6 years as a member of the Board of Regents, and have just thoroughly enjoyed that, and I think done some good things along the way. My particular skills have been in financial management, facilities management and construction, investments. Budgeting in particular is something I have worked with quite a bit. I've got some philosophies there. Number one, you ought to plan long range. We don't do that much. I think you try to save a little every year and plow that back into new things. I think some of the issues that we need to deal with at the university are, the role of the university in the education system in Minnesota, how we will reach the top three of a research institution, tuition, long-range planning, and leadership changes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Allen. Ms. Rasmussen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, members of the Joint Commission, thank you for your time today. My name is Ann Rasmussen. I'm a candidate for a region from Congressional District 7, and I appreciate your time today. A little bit of history on me. I grew up in Ada, Minnesota, which is just south of Crookston, for those of you who are familiar with the northwest part of the state. It's a rural area, a very small town. I left there and came down to the Twin Cities area to obtain my education. Ended the College of St. Catherine for 4 years, and then decided that I wanted a master's degree in public affairs, applied to the university, and on a whim decided I might take advantage of their dual degree program. At that time, it was relatively new. The law school and the Humphrey Institute were offering programs where you could basically attend both institutions and get a degree, a law degree, and a master's degree in about 3.5 years, and that's what I did. It was a wonderful, wonderful education. After I completed my studies there, I went back to Crookston to do what I thought would be a summer internship, and it's turned out to be a permanent move for me. I work in a law firm there. I'm a partner in a general practice firm in that small town. It's about 8,000 people. We do just about every kind of law there, and it's been a wonderful experience for me. My husband and I live there. We're raising our two children there, and it is a very, very good place. In speaking with many of you over the past few weeks, I tend to get basically three questions when visiting with you, and I want to answer that for the committee as a whole, those questions. The first one that I'm always asked is, do I understand the role of a regent? And I most certainly do. I understand that the Board of Regents, is their mission is to set broad policy and then charge the administration in implementing that policy. And the board also needs to monitor to make sure that the goals and plans that they have set for the university are being followed by the administration. I have no desire whatsoever to micromanage the university. I think that's an impossible task and not one that I would take on. I've also been asked by many of you why I want to be a regent. And to simply state it, and I'm sure many of you have these same feelings, is that I love the state of Minnesota. I'm so glad that I grew up here. I'm proud to be raising my family here. This is just a wonderful place to be. And I see the University of Minnesota system as a critical part of the state. And whether or not the average citizen of Minnesota realizes it or not, they are tied into the university. Whether or not they've gotten their education there or their children do, the economics, research, medical care is all part of it. Because of the time issue, I'll go over some qualities that I possess that I believe would make me an excellent regent. Certainly my law degree. I have an analytical mind. I've had a world-class education here in the state, and I can apply that to the Board of Regents. I understand the differences in rural areas and urban areas, lived in both for significant periods of time. I've got board experience on a local level, but what I've learned at that local level can easily be translated into the Board of Regents, and I believe that I can be an asset. I have a lot of energy, I work hard, I'm dedicated, I love learning, and I understand how the board system works. Now, I'm 100% Norwegian. I've said enough about myself. You can feel free to ask both Mr. Allen and I questions. My time is up. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, come forward. Are there questions of the candidate?
No, thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm just going to repeat this question as we go on, so the people are coming up. You've already had the question, but again, we know what the main role of the University of Minnesota in terms of academics and research, but we see across the nation many men's athletic programs are being eliminated. And what is your view on the role of Title IX? The intent is there is equality for programs for both men and women, but we're seeing a lot of men's programs eliminated. What is your catch on that?
Mr. Allen.
Well, I believe that, first of all, you have to have equal programs. If you can't increase the resources, and this is certainly a poor time to talk about increasing the resources overall, if you can't increase the resources, then you do have to even up with what you have to work with. I know that's meant some hard times for some men's programs, but I think if you look back over the years, you would say it used to be pretty uneven the other way. There were no women's programs at all when we had many men's programs. I don't like to see them go, but I don't see the resources for changing that either right now.
Okay, Ms. Rasmus, keep in mind the 2 minutes limit. Ms. Rasmus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the issue. I also understand that there are other issues that play in into this decision-making, income generation, and it's just the question that you are asking is a multi-level question, and I have to agree that there are, especially in these economic times, limitations on resources, but that has to be balanced appropriately, and certainly we have to follow what the law and rules are with regard to Title IX. Do I like to say that programs should be eliminated? Not necessarily, but I do think in this situation that those decisions might have to be made.
Thank you. Senator Sanchin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the candidates. Again, in what major ways would you want the University of Minnesota to look differently if you are elected for your 6-year term?
Ms. Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe coming up in the next 6 years, we'll be finding new leadership for the university. I hope that during that time that we are able to find leaders that are visionaries, that not only can deal with the immediate problems that are facing the university, but can look long-term into developing programs and constantly improving the University of Minnesota system. We have a great educational system, but we need to be vigilant to make sure that we continue to be the best and continue to make improvements on that. I would like to see more students. I would like to see that we are able to provide an affordable education. And I better wrap it up. Yes. Sorry.
Mr.
I'm a lawyer. I can't
Mr.
help myself.
Senator Latz made a comment at a higher education committee meeting about 2 weeks ago, and I thought it was significant. He said, the university has moved from being a public university to a university that has substantial public support. He's right in what he has said, but I don't think we can ever lose sight of the fact that it needs to remain a public university. But to do that, the one thing that I want to see changed is that we have a long-range plan, and by that I mean 10 years. We've pushed for that, and that is now happening, but it has some ways to go. But I would like to see us have a long-range plan so that we know where all the resources are coming from. And I'd like to see us have, if you will, a new social contract with the legislature on how we work together on current funding, reserves, and what have you to make that happen. We're on the verge of that.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems all my other two colleagues on the committee are asking the same question, a variation of my question. I asked earlier how you see the University of Minnesota fitting into the economic development of the state. As a region that would represent a more rural or more outstate or greater distance from the metro area, how do you see the role of the university in helping the 7th congressional district? I'm heading
yeah,
up to your
yeah.
neighborhood this weekend. You better be careful. I know where you live.
I think is it your turn, Mr. Allen?
I think it is. I think that many things that would help with the state can come from the rural areas. When we say rural, I presume you mean just outside the Twin Cities. Well, that includes now Rochester, but also the traditional places of Duluth and Crookston and Morris. Morris is doing some amazing things with energy work. Crookston, I think, is doing some very good work up there also. So I think that they have a role. It is important. Tom Simpson, who I know has talked with this group, has pointed out that our failure to put more money into research in the state a few years ago is part of the problem we have now. Clearly the recession is the big problem, but also part of our problem is we have not had as many inventions that have been turned into new formations of businesses as we have had in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen.
Thank you. The University of Minnesota has an enormous impact on communities. I see it every day. I'm at UMC's campus every day myself going to pick up my son from daycare. And the impact is not only a dollar and cents kind of impact. You can do studies and say that the presence of the University of Minnesota in Crookston results in X number of dollars, but it's more than that. It is a connection. By having that campus in Crookston, it provides a connection to the state, a connection to the university system as a whole. We need to have every Minnesotan be connected and interested and concerned about the University of Minnesota, and a great way to do that is by having these campuses and organizations outside the Twin Cities area.
Thank you. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the earlier candidates talked about the university's historical land grant mission, and I'm wondering what that means to each of you.
Ms. Lansford.
What that means to me is that the University of Minnesota has a mission and an obligation to provide an education to the populace, to as many people as we can, with a focus on the liberal arts and technical aspects, but that we have, that is our duty, is to do the best that we can to provide an education to as many people as we can, and of course that means taking a look at the affordability aspect.
Mr. Allen.
The Land Grant Act was a great step forward in providing education for far more of our population than we ever had before.
and for spreading that information around. We need to be true to the mission of that. But to do that, we've got to get the control of tuition. And I believe we can do that with long-range planning, identifying the resources, and saying the tuition is not the catch-all. We tend right now, we don't mean to, but we tend to say, let's find the resources from everywhere else, and then we'll make it up with tuition. Can't do that. Tuition's got to be a policy that you stick to, and then you find the resources to make that policy happen. That's what it means to me to live up to that land grant act of the 1860s.
Thank you very much, both of you, and appreciate your appearance in front of the committee. Good luck. Good luck driving home. We'll bring down the 6th congressional district now, since we have 3, and I think Mr. Frobenius probably has a little drive home too. Mr. Frobenius, why don't you come down first, since you are the incumbent, and remember the time limit.
Chair Pappas, I will comply with your time limits, obviously. I'm John Frobenius. I'm from St. Cloud and currently serving as the board regent member from Congressional District 6. I want to thank you for the opportunity to serve on this board. I've learned a lot. I've worked hard. I've been effective. And I've added value to the University of Minnesota. My background is in healthcare management. I took over a troubled community hospital in St. Cloud in the mid-80s. The experience has been excellent preparation for my service on the Board of Regents. I had an opportunity to be involved in leading a transformation of that organization into the 5th largest system, with the creation of significant clinical services that not only were at the sort of the top end of the spectrum of healthcare, but also were in the safety gap levels of low-income community clinics, teaching in adolescent and adult mental health. Nationally recognized for quality, but the important part of this is that we had the vision of a regional center. We implemented it, we did the hard work of execution, adapting and making this work, and put it with the efficiencies to make it viable and the quality be measured to assure value in the organization. We kept it as an organization community-based, governed by the strongest, well-developed community leaders. I've served along the way in a variety of leadership roles with state, regional, and national boards in healthcare organizations, as well as in the private sector. I've chaired a variety of these boards, been involved in executive searches on the Hospitals Association boards that I've chaired with the AHA and even with St. Cloud State in our area. You and I have invested 6 years in my experiences in growth as a regent at the University of Minnesota. It's been a blend of my governance and executive experience in complex healthcare organizations with my learnings on the Board of Regents. What have I done on that board? I've chaired 2 major committees, an investment advisory committee, multiple work groups that have explored specific areas or improved board functioning. Most recently involved in the Academic Health Center governance, 2 of us are representing the board on the next level of convergence with Fairview, the University of Minnesota, and Practice Group. Strategic positioning, planning, and others are a variety of the experiences that I've had. We've even made the audit function exciting. What happens now at the university? We must adapt to some severe budget cuts and come out stronger. We must place our leadership with an effective search and implementation. We must strengthen some relationships. And we must keep the transformation going with outstanding education. I'm a pragmatic, get-it-done business guy with a strong track of record of working in very complex organizations with probing, challenging questions, insightful analysis, data-driven decision-making, measurement of results, continuous improvement, and doing my best for the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to be considered.
Thank you very much, Genius. Why don't we have Shelberg come down next?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. And in this quest, I have discovered universal truth, and that is that you put us through this process so we can feel the pain of what you all have to go through in your campaign. I'd like to just tell you briefly a little bit about my background. I came over here from Norway as a journalist. I'm still recovering, but I didn't give up my inquisitive mind and the ability to ask hard questions. I'm a businessman. Only in this country and perhaps in this state could you come over with $50 in your pocket and run that up to $100 million a year in sales. So I'm very, very appreciative, and I would like to give back, and I have been trying to do that for the past 3 decades. I own businesses in Minneapolis and in Golden Valley, in Tanzania and in Norway. I have an international outlook. I'm trained in the European educational system, and I'm trained in the American educational system. I've been a student at university. I'm a graduate of McAllister and of Tufts University. I went to one of the finest law schools in the country without becoming a lawyer. I figured the country had enough of those. There are several things that I bring to the table. I have 3 decades of governance in higher education at McAllister for 12 years, Chris Davis for 3 years on the Business Advisory Board, and 7 years at Augsburg, as well as 6-7 years on the Embassy of Norway's Higher Education Board. I have a similar 3 decades of governance in healthcare. The legislature was kind enough to appoint me chairman of Gillette Children's Hospital, and I restructured that by restructuring the two positions that reported to me, being the administrator and the medical director. I also have something that's important to the university, and that is diversity. I don't need to study diversity. I've lived diversity. I was married to an African woman for 36 years. I have 2 children, which by American definition are black. I've been married in the Catholic Church. I've been married in the Lutheran Church. I have a daughter who's a Lutheran. I have 2 kids, older kids, who are Buddhists. I know something about diversity. I have a strong record of leadership, and I define leadership a little differently. I think that the difference between management and leadership is that managers tend to preserve the status quo, and leaders, on the other hand, tend to challenge the status quo, and that's the school that I come down in. I've been involved with leading a number of institutions, and I may be the only person in this room who can claim to have been directly the boss of President Bob Brunings, as he served on 2 boards that I chaired in the medical field. I headed up a 10,000-member group of entrepreneurs when I was chairman of the American International Automobile Dealers Association, which also included serious international negotiations in Japan and in Germany. I have a long-standing relationship with the university. I carry the president's pin proudly, having been a donor annually since 1972 to the graduate scholarship funds. My brother was over here as a foreign student. I spent a lot of time at the university at that time. And I worked intimately with not only President Brunings, but also with Dean Aldi and many of the other key deans at the university, as well as with the Vice President Robert Jones in planning their trip to Africa. Thank you very much. That tells you a little bit about me.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And finally, Ms. Roberts. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, members of the Joint Committee on Katherine Roberts. And I would like to thank you for providing me the opportunity to appear here today. I have met with most of you, and I know that you have my materials in front of you, and believe that you know I am presently serving in the role of CEO of Ecumen, which is a nonprofit company based here that serves about 10,000 older adults a year, primarily in rural communities around the state of Minnesota, with annual revenues of about $120 million a year. Also from my materials, you'll know that I have had a relationship with the University of Minnesota as a student twice. I received my undergraduate degree from the University of Minnesota and went back later and completed my doctoral work as well. I've also had a professional relationship with the University of Minnesota, really spanning my full career. The professional relationship really started, my first opportunity was when I was given the great job of staffing a Blue Ribbon Commission on the Future of Post-Secondary Education. And that committee was chaired by former Governor Elmer L. Anderson, and it's where really I first thought deeply about the issues around post-secondary education. Most recently, Ecumen has been working with the Humphrey Institute and about a month ago put on a big policy presentation on ways to find alternative funding sources for aging services rather than being dependent on Medicaid dollars. Again, I want to thank all of you for the time also that you've given me in individual meetings. The conversations that I've had with you have been really helpful, and they have been really valuable, both in understanding the depth of concern that you have about this great institution of ours, and also the support that you show unfailingly for the University of Minnesota. I've listened to all of you, and while we covered many topics, sometimes not necessarily related to the University of Minnesota, at least three themes emerged, which I thought you might like to hear. The first is, and we've heard this repeated many times today, you believe access is absolutely critical and that tuition needs to be within reach. You also expect the Regents to have the capacity and the willingness to ask tough questions and be willing to challenge the university when it's appropriate and when it is needed. And finally, you recognize clearly that we'll be replacing the president of the university over the next six years, and that will be a daunting task and one of utmost importance. And again, those themes that I heard in the conversations are repeating themselves as you ask the questions of the candidates today. I know well the line between policy and management. My experience in a variety of governing bodies, whether I was serving as a member of the board, a chair of the board, or staff to a board, has taught me the difference between good governance and great governance. Policy set by the legislature and the Board of Regents sets the future for the university and, in many ways, the future of the state. I'm fortunate to have a widely varied career in complex organizations with broad stakeholder groups, and I have a record of success in both good times and troubled times. My experience in both the public and nonprofit sectors tells me there are no guarantees, but I will assure you that I will work steadfastly as a Regent if given the honor in a way that moves policy forward in the best possible way in order to meet the three missions of the University of Minnesota. I will do this in challenging times as well as good. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, why don't you come back down? Yeah, we're getting a third chair right now. And we're ordered to do that before I call them down. So, questions of the candidates? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to be fair to all the candidates. Again, back to the title line issue, we all realize that the academics and research and the role of the university is very important to our state. But we also know that the Division I sports, the revenue that brings into the university is important too. And that we've seen across the country many men's sports eliminated in compliance with Title IX. What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Corbin, go first.
Chair Rick Corbin, Representative Ever. Title IX is an activity where the intent is clear, the detail has caused some difficulties. Fortunately, at the university, we're currently in compliance with Title IX. Our athletic department is in the black, so this is an issue that I don't see that we have currently in front of us in terms of having any pressures to do some things. It's done by some strong management that's been done to reorganize some of the athletic management process in order to keep that balance. I hope we don't face that issue in the near future.
Mr. Berg.
Well, let me use an analogy. For many years, I was a pretty hefty donor to the Miss Black America pageant, and every year I made the contribution, I made the statement that I hope this will be the last year that we will need to do this, and the first year that a black woman is elected the Miss Minnesota, I will quit contributing to your cause. Very glad that I've had to quit contributing to that cause, and I look at Title IX in the same way. You need to balance the resources that I have on the table, but I'm absolutely, totally committed to the thoughts and the underlying law.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would come at it in a little bit different perspective. I'm confident when Title IX was developed and passed into law that its purpose was to do exactly as you described, to equalize sports so that actually I could participate and now my daughter can participate. I'm equally confident that the originators never thought that what would happen is that boys would lose the opportunity to participate. And if that is in fact what's occurring, I have every confidence you are stating it as it is true, probably time for the feds to look at that law and do what's necessary to meet its intent again.
Other questions from members? Senator Lamb.
Thank you, and thank you, all three of you, for coming forward. The governor's proposed budget, if enacted, would reduce the funding for the university to below that of the sources of research grants and from tuition. In effect, I think, making the state of Minnesota a minority shareholder in our own flagship university. My concern, in light of the other questions raised about the land grant history, is that we would become the NIH and Pell Grant institution instead. What role are you willing to play in connection with the governor's office to try to bring forward more state resources through our budget process to support the university?
Mr. Berg.
I'll actually come at it from a little different angle that perhaps than most, and that is that I think over term the university needs to get to the point where it's less, not more, dependent on the state of Minnesota. And in order to get there, that can't be a one-year process. It has to be a long, linear process. But in the interim, since we have this situation on hand that must be dealt with, I would work very closely, if elected as a member of the Board of Regents, with the state to find equitable solutions to that question, and it's not going to be easy.
Ms. Roberts.
Well, first of all, that comment makes me sad. I think it's a sad statement to say that the state of Minnesota becomes a minority stockholder in its great educational institution, and that in itself is an issue. How would I behave about that? I would consider those that issue to be brought before the Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents would discuss that as a group, and whatever the Board of Regents, however they decided to deal with it strategically, is how I would act in the governor's office representing that board, not representing myself.
And finally, Mr. Skeen.
Chair Riccovino, Senator, in a recent Senate committee, you made the wonderful comparison of the challenges of the university, of both broader access, higher quality, and to do all that with less resources. The planning process of the university is one of the effective tools to lay out the university case in a variety of scenarios. Regan Allen talked about the stronger financial planning that we are implementing at the university. I think we do that. We lay that mission out in front of legislators, in front of the governor's office, but more importantly, we collectively do as many of us have done, and that's be talking about this in a variety of organizations in our communities across the state. The university needs to be well regarded in its work and its representation by its stakeholders.
Okay, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the budget and the need to consider cost savings at the University of Minnesota, I'm interested in your thoughts about innovations and new models of providing education that the University of Minnesota might entertain in order to continue to provide a quality education.
Let's see. Ms. Roberts, you're going to go first this time.
I think that's a great question. And we all know the University of Minnesota is actually studying that question itself on how to deliver alternative methods for students to come out with the same great education they have going in and sitting in their classrooms. I suspect over time that many models will be introduced. The first that will probably take precedence is any kind of learning online. And we know there are lots of classes that kids can take, I can take, and do just as well by myself sitting in front of my computer as I do coming in and sitting in a building. On the other hand, there's also kinds of learning that you need to come together and be in the building and have the lab and have the resources in front of you. I think it'll be a mix of that, and I expect that you'd see more education happening outside of the traditional campus than you do see today.
Mr. Dean.
Online learning is a tool that fits in well with the model and does have some gains as we go forward. The Senate members of this committee recently spent some time in the engineering portions of the university seeing that occurring in the mechanical engineering area. My own field of healthcare administration has now two tracks to the master's degree, one online and one on campus, and some combination of the two. The university will continue to integrate and is looking for every possible improvement in this area as part of the continuous improvement effort that I believe is going on at the university, and you're seeing some good strides, and you'll see more.
And finally, Mr. Byrd.
Well, first of all, I'm a product of a new method of educational delivery. I got my master's in a hybrid situation in which there were two-week components at the beginning, middle, and the end of the year, and the rest was all delivered either over the internet or by DVDs that were mailed out. And at my advanced age, I found it very helpful to be able to stop the professor in midstream and take notes and go back to it again. It's a model that will allow the university to be less dependent on traditional bricks and mortars over time. It's easy to find people with deep pockets, relatively easy that is, and an ego to put a name on the building. It is not easy to maintain it for its lifespan. That's where a lot of the costs come in.
Okay. Senator Stanton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the candidates, once again, in what major ways would you want the University of Minnesota to look differently if you are elected to a six-year term?
Mr. Byrd. Mr. Byrd.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I think that to the extent that the university has expressed its deep commitment to being one of the top three research universities in the world, not in Minnesota, not in the Midwest, not in the United States, it needs to be judged by some international standards. And I can tell you with a great deal of confidence that a few years from now, no one is going to pay a whole lot of attention to who won the little brown jug, but people will tell a lot of, or pay a lot of attention to who won the Nobel Prize, who happened to be on staff at the University of Minnesota. We need to focus very extensively on playing by the rules of the environment that we're choosing. It's not sufficient, contrary to what some of you have expressed, to just be a Minnesota institution. We need to be a world-based institution if that's the environment we're playing in.
Ms. Roberts.
I'd like to see three things look different. I would like to see the new president in place and strongly leading the university into the future. Secondly, I'd like to see reasonable policies adopted that work, that guarantee access to students and reasonable tuition. And thirdly, I'd like to see the university have a more robust role in taking the bully pulpit and telling us about how the university fits into the state's picture and how the university then can make that vision of what our state can be happen.
And Mr. Fabini.
I would like to see us completed our current phase of the strategic transitioning process and looking to the next level, becoming a more affordable institution, to be even stronger as an organization, demonstrating continuous improvement more efficiently and more effectively. I also believe we must have a defined revenue stream in place, and our financial planning will help set the tone for that. And lastly, I want to speak to the diversity of the university. Some significant efforts have been going on, have been more focused of late to reflect the growing change in our student population in the state, and that our university will reflect that mirror in the world around us in the diversity of its population.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You maybe heard my previous question about tuition being used to make up the cuts, that the 15% cuts in 2003. The governor's proposed a 10.7% cut. I don't know what the legislature will do. We're certainly, all of us on higher ed, are hopeful it won't be to that extent. But how should you respond to this legislative cut in terms of tuition? What would be your suggestions and advice to your fellow board members?
Ms. Roberts.
Some of you have heard me say this before. I think there are probably three strategies you can use in dealing with the tuition issue. The first is you can become really, really strong in your philanthropy and just raise money as fast as you can and get into the endowment. It's not going to solve the problem today, but could in the future. Secondly, you can reappropriate money within the university and start to prioritize programs and shift money to support the tuition issue. And third, you can raise revenue entrepreneurially or any way, really, I guess all entrepreneurially, in order to increase your revenue stream so that tuition can be more affordable. And the strategies will all occur in one of those three buckets.
Mr. Frobenius.
You heard another reader previously talk about some of the budget principles. I won't reiterate those. Last time, a third of that cut was taken in the form of tuition increases. The market won't bear that today. People can't afford that. So we have to continue to take this, what would be now about $86 million, out of a combination of operations. And what we end up having to do in tuition will be heavily feathered at both the lowest income and the middle income level. Since they can't get to the double-digit activities. Lastly, the revenue sources and the continuous improvement are critical parts of this, have been underway, and will continue to get stronger. We will search in every nook and cranny for other sources of revenue, short-term and long-term.
Mr. Berg.
I agree with both of the other candidates. I think that it's unsustainable to have the type of increases that we've seen in recent years. We must keep it down. And over term, we need to find a new model.
Okay. One last question. Senator Roblin, your question was asked.
Senator Pappas asked.
Okay. One last. Just for Ms. Roberts, you've mentioned a couple of times the new president being elected in the next term, and I'm just wondering, will you support me for president of the University of Minnesota? Okay, thank you all very much. And the last, but not least, certainly, the 4th Congressional District, Ms. Pompas, would you come down first, please? Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much. It's very, very nice to be with all of you this afternoon. And I'm glad to have a few minutes to talk about our common interests in the future of the University of Minnesota and the ways in which the regions can have an impact on that. I don't really have to go through all of my experiences and credentials. I think you all have had the materials that we circulated, but I want to just review that a little bit in terms of what I think would be essential when it comes to looking at the role of the regents. I think it's very critical at this time to elect regents who know the world of higher education, who are experienced board members, who understand the appropriate role of the regents in the governance of the university, and who are fully cognizant of the challenges facing the university today and in the near future. I also think it would be helpful to find people who participated in searches for major leadership positions, who had to manage large and complex organizations themselves, who've dealt with economic downturns, and who have the ability to think both long and short term about the future of the universities. From those perspectives, I want to offer myself as a candidate who could hit the ground running, because all of these are the experiences that I bring to this discussion. As I've talked with many of you, I can sense your pride and your sense of ownership that you have of the university. And you've also mentioned some of the issues that you think are most pressing. So I thought I'd just give you my perspective as a potential regent on some of those questions and issues that we have discussed in our conversations. You want the university to continue its unique mission of research and discovery, teaching and learning, and outreach and public service. This is the mission statement, to benefit the people of the state, the nation, and the world. There is obviously no other institution in Minnesota that's equipped to carry out this broad and diverse mission that extends statewide, that provides degrees at every level, and is publicly supported. And while my background has been primarily in private education, I know the university well, and I'm completely supportive of its unique and critical mission in the state of Minnesota. You want the university to be accessible and affordable to students, and we've had quite a bit of discussion here about affordable, keeping tuition within affordable limits and supplementing it with financial aid. The university has greatly increased its financial aid resources, I'm told, especially during the fund drive for the new stadium when apparently a lot of new alumni were discovered who became supporters of the university. Certainly, keeping and enlarging that group is going to be a significant priority going forward. And in fact, when it comes to finding sources of support, there really are only a few that can be tapped besides tuition, and that includes
what we call gifts. And so expanding that whole gifts possibility is going to be very essential, particularly in creating scholarship aid from people who would want other people to have the opportunity they had of attending this fine university. But the term accessibility is more than just financial accessibility, because campuses are not going to be accessible if students are not properly prepared for higher education, if they have had parents who have not had the opportunity themselves and don't encourage it, and they're certainly not going to be accessible if they can't accommodate the cultural differences among the students of the future. So these are the qualitative aspects of the accessibility issue, and I've worked with many groups concerned with these issues, and I can bring that background to the discussion at the top level. Oh, time's up. Well,
thank you. Thank you very much.
I make a final sentence statement? Well,
Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm pretty easy. Quickly.
Okay. I just wanted to say that I think the university needs a group of regents who can critically assess the plans for the future and provide the outside view that board members bring, and I hope to be a member of that group. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Beeson, welcome.
Regents Barukabina, is that the word of the day then? Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the Joint Committee for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. I've enjoyed getting acquainted with all of you, and it's been a tremendous experience. And to the RCAC Council, Chair Fisher, thank you for your public service as well. I've been a resident of St. Paul for 30 years, as well as been employed in the city for 3 decades. Of all 12 regents, I'm the only candidate or sitting regent who is a resident of either the city of Minneapolis or St. Paul. I've had a little different path than others in terms of my career, both the public and private sector experience. I respect and understand the private sector, the public sector that is, even though I'm a businessman presently. Worked for 10 years for Mayor George Latimer, working on the Ordway Theater, the Riverfront Project, as well as affordable housing. My wife and I are both graduates of the university, as well as my daughter who's here. She graduated recently, and that gives me an inside look at the university from a parent's standpoint. My folks both attended the university. My dad went there after the war through the benefit of the GI Bill. I've had 20 years experience as a small businessman in St. Paul, adjacent to the St. Paul campus, founded actually by university faculty during World War I. We're a Main Street bank. We're the good guys, not the bad guys, just like the one in your town and your community. We have a $250 million social enterprise serving small business, not-for-profit, and families and students. Real people with real problems, good grounding for someone who is going to be dealing with a lot of money that has impacts on students. I also understand good governance. I served as founder and chair of the Central Florida Partnership. That is the biggest project in the East Metro since Theater State. I worked with labor, worked with business, worked with the two cities and the two counties. And because of the good governance collaborative style, all 7 Ramsey County commissioners are endorsing my candidacy. I've had substantial other nonprofit experience, about 50 other boards. I've done national hiring and been on searches. One that results in the hiring of Dr. Patricia Harvey. I'll bring value to that process. That is the most important decision during the next term, aside from getting the economic troubles cleared up. There's been a lot of great work at the university. I want to acknowledge those regents who have been part of that process. The coordinate campuses have really been energized. They've got their own signature. Last Friday, I went down to Rochester, met with the new chancellor, toured it, and there is a great hybrid approach that's going on down there. And we can talk about that in the question and answers, but I'm very impressed with what I saw there. The next 6 years are going to be very different, though. It's going to be a very different operating environment. Staff, mental energy is going to shift inordinately to finance and to decision-making driven by cost, benefit analysis, and priorities. To both nurture staff and provide arm's-length oversight, the board, like all governing bodies, needs skill diversity and balance. If you believe this board could use additional financial leadership, I'd submit my name as someone who has a broad financial background, who's knowledgeable in areas of finance, who spent 30 years helping change occur with clients and building models. 2 things quickly emerged from my visits with you. First, if stakeholders want Regents to be really engaged.
Well, we gave you. Go ahead, you got 30 seconds.
I'm supporting it for presidency. second is that the stakeholders want us to be the keeper of the mission, and I take that seriously, having come through the public education, and I know it's a balance between research and the other legs on the stool, but I will be a keeper of the mission. Thank you for all your courtesies. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And Ms. Pompas, come on down then, and we'll go and represent Detmer. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Actually, Mr. Chair, I haven't changed it, okay. But again,
I thought you were going to announce you were running again.
Yeah.
Go on.
Really? No, I didn't. Again, we all understand the importance of our education system and the research here at the University of Minnesota. And but we see nationwide many universities, Division I, are having problems meeting the compliance of the Title IX issues or Title IX rules and laws. What is your thoughts about Title IX and relevancy with the University of Minnesota?
Well, let me take it from the angle of the purpose of sports in athletics and higher education. I grew up in an era where there were really no sports for girls. I always figured that my role on the debate team was about the closest I was going to come to competitive action and teamwork, the kinds of things that you learn by doing sports. But if you think about the ultimate purpose of sports, which develops character, teamwork, school spirit, and so on, there's no reason why one gender ought to have more access to it than the other. I think everybody would agree with that, and I assume that's the basis for Title IX. So at this point, I think people have to make judicious choices. If you assume that the populations and the institutions are roughly 50-50, and that's probably not even the case, it's usually there are usually more females than males in most institutions of higher education. It might be a matter of providing opportunities, but simply not being able to provide quite the variety that's always been there. And so that's what I think is happening. The same variety can't be offered, but you can still offer opportunities to the same number of kids, and it would be the job of the institution to figure out the best way to do that.
Mr. Gason,
when we constructed the TCF Bank Stadium, one of the arguments was that Minnesota had not generated sufficient overall revenue, and because we're in the Metrodome, we lagged way behind the Big Ten. I'm interested to see what those projections are once the new stadium opens, to see if there is available money for adding, you know, men's soccer or doing something. That may not be the right thing to do in this economy, but I am a big believer in Title IX. We have two daughters, both of whom have played sports. I think that regulation sort of flowed back down into high schools and became sort of an expectation that girls should and could play sports. Big believer in it.
Okay, Representative Pappas, or excuse me, Senator Pappas, and then Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I respect that title, representative, since I used to be one.
Yes. Many of you good folks over here used to be one. Some of you bad folks didn't, but okay.
We've talked here today about the university's mission to become a top research institution. We've talked about the university's mission to be a land-grant institution. There's some tension there. How can the university provide access for first-generation, low-income students whose parents didn't go to college and still maintain high standards?
Mr. Beeson.
You know, in the urban communities, there's a lack of trust about the university with the disappearance of General College. I think there's some trust issues. I think there needs to be more outreach into some of the urban communities. Making the transfer process seamless, I know there was a big announcement, and that's always a work in progress. That's a big barrier psychologically and just sort of practically, getting kids who are maybe a little underprepared or who can't afford the university's tuition, might not qualify for aid. So we have to make that really, that transition go well. That would be my answer.
I made a few references to that in my earlier remarks, but I would say that The university really has to do the reaching out, particularly, I think, to the high schools, if not into the elementary schools, to be sure that the students are getting the level of education that's going to prepare them for university work. And I know from one of the last grants we made at the Bush Foundation, it was a high school access to college type grant, where the university went into the schools and then would provide special supports for the students once they got there. That probably has to be repeated a hundredfold as we're going along with students who are coming out of different backgrounds. One thing we know is that if you put kids in the right environment, all kids can learn, no matter how what kind of poor circumstances they come from. So the real challenge is to provide those kinds of backgrounds so kids can thrive in the right kind of educational environment.
Thank you. Senator Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was growing up, my connection to the university was through the 4-H program, which was run by the University of Minnesota Extension, of course. And on the farm, we also had connections to the general extension. When my dad found some worms on the crops, he could call the extension agent. They'd come out and look at it and tell him what it was and what he could do to treat it. It isn't done quite that way anymore. But I still have concern about 4-H youth development and outreach to the rural communities. And since you would be urban representatives, and I suspect that the candidates from the rural areas are well aware of what the needs are, but I would like to ask you what you would like to do to ensure that the university's mission to the agricultural community and youth is continued.
Ms. Pompas.
Well, I think that there's probably a couple of ways that happens. One is for the kind of example that Ann Rasmussen was pointing out, that students come from all over the state, from all the agricultural areas to the main campus of the university in Twin Cities. But the other part is to build the programs in the outlying campuses to be sure that they're reaching the students from even the remotest areas, because some of the brightest and best contributors to the state have come from very small areas where they've been able to get the kind of education to move them forward. I haven't heard that there's any thought that there would be any diminishment of the opportunities offered to students in the rural areas, but they may have to be pursued in a more direct way in order to get them fitted into the right kinds of circumstances.
Mr. Deason. Research is critical in the whole area of switchback grass as the next generation of biofuels. I know that's underway. My oldest daughter actually is a scientist, and she worked up at Cedar Creek under Dr. Tillman. That's very exciting research spawned out of the University of Minnesota. Second, online ag extension is, I know that's in use now. My wife uses it for horticultural questions. I think that's going to be a trend going forward. I know that the extension offices have been consolidated around the state, and it sounds like that has been accepted. I don't, you know, hear much. I'm not in that, you know, that market. So, research is really critical in agriculture as well as in other sciences, and I would certainly support that sort of funding. Senator Lance.
Thank you. Given the current state of the state budget, what steps do you think you or the board should take to strengthen the, minimize the reductions in state appropriations to the university, how would you think the university should handle the reduced proportion of state support in the university going forward?
Mr. Beeson. Well, first of all, as just a candidate, it's for me to sort of say how it would fall on the issue of tuition is almost disingenuous. I've not really seen the budget. I haven't cracked open the book. Intuitively, I don't like the state falling under the other funding partners as a minority funder. The areas I would look at first in terms of reductions would be the non-critical. What I don't want to disturb is the student-teacher ratio, and what I don't want to disturb is obligations we have in research. We have reputation risk if we do that. So we start, I guess, with labor expense in the non-critical areas. And I think as Regent Simmons said, labor is a big part of the cost structure there. The building costs are fixed or semi-fixed, and very quickly it gets into the people area. But I would start with areas other than teaching, and other areas other that
that don't impact that essential relationship.
Ms. Pompas.
Well, I don't think anybody would appreciate seeing those numbers, that percentages continue to decline. But as we know, universities are creative places, and even with the declines over the past decade or two, have been able to regroup and find ways of supporting themselves. I did take a look at the sources of income and note that if you add up gifts and grants and auxiliary services and all the other ways, that's about 48% of the income that comes into the university. So I'm assuming that one of the first things that would happen would be to try to increase those sources of income in order to counterbalance the income that isn't coming in through state support or through tuition. So there are probably a lot of ways that could happen. What I would like to see is the university prioritizing its needs in such a way that the programs that are going to become the key programs would be actually chosen and supported, so we create more of a lean and mean structure and be able to meet the goals and at the same time maintain the quality of the university.
Okay. Members, any further questions? If not, we will be meeting in this room at 12:30 on Tuesday then and going through the process of nominating for the entire legislature. And Senator Pappas, do you have any comments?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll let Senator Rose sit down. There's a little chair up here. Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that how pleased I am with the high level of excellence that all these candidates have presented to us. And I want to actually thank the RCAC, because I think you did come up and recommend some very, very good candidates. I feel personally very torn over several of these seats, and I just want the people who do not get nominated by the committee or by the joint convention to please continue your service in higher education. Consider the Minsky Board, which could use some raising of their level,
Senator, to that point, I have a proposal to have the legislature choose the board of the Minsky trustees for it, just like we do the regents. And I'll have that tomorrow, Mr. Still, and expect your support. Thank you.
But we really do appreciate the time you took to interview, the time you took to talk to all of us. It's a very good process for us to learn about the university, to develop our ties and our connection with the university, which I think are much stronger than they are with Minsky, except for our local institutions, because we don't go through that same process with the Minsky board members and their trustees. So thank you all again, and I feel very bad about those of you who don't get nominated, but I feel very good about such a fine group of candidates who want to serve the University of Minnesota.
Members, with that, and I want to thank all of you for your participation too, and I'm looking forward to Tuesday. But I do want to remember to keep in mind that you're legislators, and there's a constitutional charge that you can do whatever you want, regardless of the outcome of these suggestions. And there may be, and I don't know what the result is going to be. In one, we have three candidates now, so who knows what the outcome is going to be as far as the suggestion to the full joint committee. But I appreciate the commission's proposals, and I think they have really given us some excellent candidates. So with that, members, we'll see you Tuesday. Meeting adjourned.